This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. It would be hard to find anyone in the world who hasn't heard of Osama bin Laden. But as much as we know about what he's done, we know very little about who he really is. Reporter Peter Bergen analyzes world terrorism for CNN. He is one of the few Western reporters who's actually spoken with bin Laden. He's out with a new book that tries to get at the personality of this complex and infamous figure. He's done it by talking with people who were and are close to bin Laden, by gathering tape and quotes from other news sources. Osama bin Laden, I Know, is the title of the book. Author Peter Bergen is my guest today, and we welcome your calls at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Peter Bergen, welcome.
Good afternoon.
You know, when I read your book, the thing that struck me was the difference between Osama bin Laden and the murderous fanatics the world has known in most of its history. They seem to have been driven by anger and resentment. He is driven by faith.
That seems to be the case, although I guess people who believe that God is on their side can be quite dangerous on occasion. Certainly bin Laden believes that God is on his side. And as the picture that emerges of him as a sort of a young, as a teenager really, is somebody who is ultra, ultra religious, somebody who is fasting twice a week, somebody who is praying seven times a day, more than the usual five times a day that Islam requires. Even by the standards of the conservative Saudi Arabia of the 70s, he sort of stood out as a religious zealot, but you know, widely admired by people for his religiosity, for also for his generosity. He would organize religious entertainments for poor people in Jeddah, where the city he grew up in.
And his determination. I mean, he just doesn't shrink from a fight, and he puts himself in harm's way at times when it seems utterly lunatic thing to do.
Well, yes. I mean, what transformed him was precisely what you're referring to, which was fighting against the Soviets in Afghanistan. That transformed him, from all accounts, from a shy, retiring, almost monosyllabic son of a multi-billionaire into somebody who believed in his own leadership abilities, who was fighting, leading his own force of Arabs into battle, and by all accounts, fighting rather bravely.
I'm talking with Peter Bergen today. The Osama bin Laden I Know is the title of his new book. He has taken an oral history and gotten other accounts of Osama bin Laden to get a portrait of the man. You know what's interesting? When I read the book, I think we fail to realize the impact of the 1967 war, the Middle East war, on radicalizing Arabs and Muslims and showing them that this is really a fight for their lives. This changes everything.
I think that's very, very true. I mean, the 67 war was supposed to be a victory, a quick victory for Egypt against Israel, and turned out to be a devastating defeat. Within hours, the Egyptian army was on the run, and basically it called into question the whole Arab nationalist and socialist ideology which was underpinning the region at the time. And that led, there was something called the Sawa, the Islamic Awakening, that was really provoked by the defeat in the war, which was seen as almost a civilizational defeat. And then the execution of Sayyid Qutb, who's sort of the Lenin of this movement, happened. It had happened just before the war, the 1967 war in 1966. I think that also energized this movement because Sayyid Qutb's martyrdom helped fuel this religious awakening, which, like the hippie revolution in the 60s in America, was a movement of the young against the old. Basically, the old ideas, of course, they had very different ideological underpinnings, but it seemed that the old ideas didn't work, and a turn towards religion and a much more aggressive sort of Islamist interpretation of it was a solution to the region's ills.
Sure, but that's the paradox, where it's young and old. In this case, in the Muslim world, the young are turning back to religion, whereas in the West, the young are quite pointedly turning away from it.
Right, certainly turning against, they were turning against the Vietnam War, and they were turning against, conservative ideas about culture and society.
And another turning point for Osama bin Laden is obviously the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
Made a profound difference to him. I mean, there were two events that transformed bin Laden as an adult. One was the Afghan invasion of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. The other one was the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia a decade later. But, you know, whatever else bin Laden is, it turns out that he's a rather brave individual. And fighting against the Soviet army during the 80s was, quite a difficult thing. They had total air superiority. And bin Laden, in an almost suicidal move, set up a base for his Arabs right outside a Soviet base. And he actually tells one of the people in the book that we set the base up right near the Soviets so we would attract as much enemy fire as possible. almost a sort of kamikaze mission.
Well, almost, or it was a kamikaze mission. It seems to me from everything that people were saying about him at that time and even today, the goal seems to be martyrdom.
No doubt. On the back of the book, Abu Jandal, who's one of bin Laden's bodyguards, is quoted as saying, "I was given a pistol and two bullets by bin Laden. If he was going to be captured, I would use one to shoot him and then kill myself."
I'm talking to Peter Bergen, the author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know, and you can give us a call at 800-989-8255 if you want to join this conversation. Richard is on the line. Hello, Richard.
Yes. Before 9/11, the Taliban were extremely unpopular in Afghanistan, and militants were, being discredited around the world. Is it possible that he actually wanted the United States to attack Afghanistan to restore to their anti-foreign spirit, and the only disappointment is that they're not as mad at us as they were at the Soviets?
I mean, bin Laden undoubtedly wanted the United States to attack Afghanistan in the same manner that the Soviets had, a massive ground invasion that he could then conduct a guerrilla war against. That didn't happen. The total number of U.S. troops during the war against the Taliban was maybe 300 U.S. Special Forces. Much of the fighting was conducted by the Northern Alliance. What didn't happen in Afghanistan has sort of happened in Iraq, where there is a large number of U.S. ground forces attracting a guerrilla war by al-Qaeda in Iraq.
And a more urban environment where that it makes that a lot easier. Talk, too, about the evolution, because Osama bin Laden goes to Afghanistan. He has a small band of fighters going with him, but it's not so much a war that they're fighting. They begin, it's almost like a relief effort, and it's led by Abdullah Azzam, and then it evolves. So talk a little bit about the evolution and his relationship with Azzam and how it became more militant.
Abdullah Azzam was a very interesting man, a Palestinian cleric, a real firebrand, by all accounts, a pretty enormously charismatic person. Bin Laden's father had died aged 10 in a crash, and to some extent, Abdullah Azzam may have been a father figure for him, older, much more experienced. Azzam and bin Laden founded something called the Services Office together, which basically brought Muslims from around the Muslim world to either to volunteer for the Afghan war effort. But eventually bin Laden and Azzam, one of the things I found in the book was that Azzam and bin Laden actually split, and al-Qaeda really came out of a disagreement between them, which was fairly carefully concealed at the time. Azzam wanted no truck with, overthrowing Middle Eastern governments or founding this kind of al-Qaeda-type organization. Bin Laden went ahead against the advice of his mentor, Abdullah Azzam, and also many of his family and friends, to set up al-Qaeda, which was aimed to sort of an Arab military force that would bring jihad to other places in the world.
And that would include places like Saudi Arabia, where there were Muslim governments, but as far as he was concerned, apostate governments. These are governments that aren't faithful.
Yes. Over time, bin Laden became more convinced that all the regimes in the Middle East had to go, and I think that conviction started around the time of the founding of al-Qaeda. Interestingly, in the book, you can find the founding minutes of al-Qaeda's first meetings back in late August 1988.
The book is The Osama Bin Laden I Know. Peter Bergen is its author and my guest. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-989-8255. Kathleen is on the line from Athens, Ohio. Hi, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Peter, I've heard numerous interviews with you, and you often bring up the root causes of Osama bin Laden's attitude towards the U.S. And I wanted to ask you, do you think those root causes are being addressed? And how angry was Osama after Afghanistan fell off the U.S. radar screen after the Russians were driven out of Afghanistan?
I don't think he really cared about Afghanistan falling off the U.S. Radar screen, which would have happened in 1989 when we closed our embassy there. I mean, he was basically angry about the introduction of U.S. troops into Saudi Arabia, which he saw was, quote-unquote, defiling the Holy Land. He saw it as a permanent U.S. military occupation. The forces weren't really drawn down in the numbers that he would have liked. The root causes of bin Laden's attitude towards the United States are its foreign policy. When I say that, I'm not suggesting we change it. I'm just saying that's what he is targeting us for. He's never talked about our freedoms or Hollywood or Madonna or these kinds of cultural issues. Ayatollah Khomeini had a cultural critique of the United States, called us the Great Satan. Bin Laden has really a foreign policy critique.
Yeah, and we talk about the fact that Well, here in the United States, we didn't see Osama bin Laden coming. Maybe we didn't take him seriously enough. Was he seen, because we know, and you document in the book, that there were certainly fractures within the Muslim world and controversy about his rise to power. Did other Arab leaders and other Muslim leaders see him as a threat and see him as becoming as powerful as he became?
Well, one of the perhaps unexpected things that discoveries in the book is the extent to which there was intense debate within the Taliban. A lot of senior Taliban leaders did not want bin Laden to be in Afghanistan. And basically, he only had one real important ally, which, of course, was Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. But there were a number of Taliban officials telling things. You know, one of the reasons I could write the book at all is post 9/11, you could talk to people in the Taliban. They would, instead of sort of the official line about Osama as the world's greatest guy and he's got nothing to do with terrorism, they were actually saying, well, in fact, there were intense debates about getting rid of him. We wanted to be recognized by the international community. He was bad for business. And that they really rejected the al-Qaeda and the Arabs in many cases.
The other part of the controversy was that he didn't seem to have much of a strategy. He had tactics, and he could certainly attract followers because of this bravura. But the fact is, there didn't seem to be a real overarching strategy.
I mean, his strategy is, you know, attack the far enemy, i.e. the United States, and that'll destabilize the near enemy, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Well, That's you know, I'm certainly he thinks strategically, but I think I try and outline in the book that he keeps making these big mistakes, and the biggest mistake, it turns out, was 9/11. One of his sons left him as a result of 9/11, a guy called Omar, and he's in his mid-20s. Jihadists who had fought with bin Laden said, look, 9/11 was against Islam, and also it destroyed the Taliban, and anybody who's ever sort of uttered the word jihad is now on the run. And they say that while it may have been a tactical success against the United States, it was a strategic disaster. And so bin Laden completely misread the United States. He thought of the United States as a paper tiger, attack them on 9/11, it'll be like Somalia in the 90s, we'll sort of change all our policies. Well, it turned out to be quite the opposite, and the paper tiger emerged rather enraged.
One of the things I found amazing in this book was the fact that there is a jihad magazine once all this gets underway after the Soviet invasion, and that the jihadis are, you know, this is de rigueur. Everybody's got their copy of Jihad, and a lot of the material you have in the book comes from Jihad magazine.
Yeah, this was sort of the in-flight magazine of bin Laden's and Abdullah Azzam Services Office. And one of the places it was most widely distributed was the United States. It had, you know, places like Tucson, Arizona, Brooklyn, Atlanta, Georgia, the United States was seen as an important place for fundraising. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two of al-Qaeda, actually came here on a fundraising trip in the early 90s. So his Jihad magazine was very important during the early part of this to fundraise, to raise awareness, and to recruit people.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today with Peter Bergen, author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know. It's a conversation you can join by calling us at 800-989-8255. Jeff has done just that. He called us from Cincinnati. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say I just recently graduated from college, and I studied Arab terrorism there, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book because I think that it'll touch on something that most other scholars like Rohan Gunaratna or whoever writes on al-Qaeda don't really get to, which is bin Laden's personality, which is sort of my question. I'd like you to just comment real quick, if you could, on bin Laden's appeal, his message, and how it spreads in light of the fact that as a person, bin Laden isn't terribly charismatic in the sense of a Hitler or a Lenin or any of those other revolutionary leaders. He doesn't have the same fiery rhetoric, and I was just wondering if you can comment on how the message spread the way that it did.
Thanks,
Jeff. His personality figures in.
Well, I think it's a good question. I mean, charisma may be in the eye of the beholder. I'm sure if you were in some beer hall meeting in 1923 and you saw Hitler, you may not have thought that he was such a great guy. So the same with bin Laden. One of the scenes I have in the book is a Belgian fundamentalist female by the name of Malika, who sees bin Laden on television with her husband and is so moved by this experience that they decide to move to Afghanistan in 2000. And in fact, her husband becomes the assassin of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who, of course, was bin Laden's great rival, who was killed 2 days before 9/11.
In Afghanistan.
So, you know, one of the methods that, there were a lot of different ways that I think bin Laden was able to recruit. One was, appearances on television through the internet. The guy has a very large media profile. And after the 98 embassy bombings and our rather ineffective U.S. military response 2 weeks later, I think bin Laden was turned from a sort of somewhat marginal figure into a global celebrity, And that produced a wave of recruitment. And some of the recruits talk about how exciting it is to meet bin Laden or what a moving experience it was. So, again, charisma's in the eye of the beholder. For some people, he certainly does have some form of charisma.
But let's examine the premise. You lay it out in your book. Jeff just restated it. And that's the idea that you can't really understand the movement without understanding the personality. You know there's a historical critique that says the personalities are always among us. They're just waiting for the opportunity, for the conditions, so that they gain credibility and power.
Well, I have an unfashionable view of history then, because my view of history is that people change it. And you can't explain the Holocaust without Hitler. And you can't explain the fact that the French were in Moscow in 1812 without Napoleon. It's just not possible. And you can't explain al-Qaeda without bin Laden. He found it with like, 9 other people. He was the leader from the beginning. He and Ayman al-Zawahiri, are instrumental in founding this. They've been instrumental in the ideology of al-Qaeda. They created a somewhat coherent worldview, which unfortunately a number of people have signed up for.
I guess the counter to that is that if you do that, you suggest without Osama bin Laden, there wouldn't have been this, and that the resentments of Muslim people wouldn't find some kind of an outlet that might be violent and dangerous. So we wouldn't have to worry if it only weren't for Osama and Adolf Hitler.
Okay. Well, the only experiment we can run is the history that actually happened. And 9/11 was, al-Qaeda did it. It wasn't the Animal Liberation Front or some Islamic group from Kashmir.
To what extent is al-Qaeda now broken up, and has the movement lost energy? We keep hearing that, in fact, whether or not al-Qaeda is still central, there is quite a resistance movement.
Well, I think there are three metrics for judging certainly al-Qaeda, the organization, has taken a huge hit since 9/11. Al-Qaeda, the ideological movement, I think remains pretty active, and I think the Iraq War gave it a big boost. And I think there are three metrics for that. Donald Rumsfeld famously complained, what are the metrics for? Are we winning or losing the war on terrorism? Well, terrorism figures might be one metric that's relevant. We've seen an epidemic of terrorism in 2004 and 2003. We're seeing record levels of anti-Americanism, and we're seeing Islamist parties broadly sympathetic to al-Qaeda's goals, or at least sympathetic to al-Qaeda's worldview, doing well in elections around the Muslim world. And we're seeing, a sort of not a good situation in central Iraq, where Zarqawi is doing well. So I'm not saying we're winning or losing. I'm just saying that, you can't say we're winning right now.
We're talking with Peter Bergen. More with him and his book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know, after a short break. And more of your calls at 800-989-8255. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking with author Peter Bergen. His new book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, emails at totn@npr.org. Peter, what is the you talk a little bit in the book about this notion of blowback, the fact that the CIA really created al-Qaeda or the entire Muslim fundamentalist network that we're now facing, and more or less put lie to that, or at least minimize the impact of the CIA, and say that Osama bin Laden had a bigger part in that.
Well, for clarity's purposes, CIA, obviously had a big role in the Afghan resistance, $3 billion they've supplied, but they were basically signing checks. And it's interesting, it's a widely held view on the left that somehow CIA was involved in the founding of al-Qaeda or helped bin Laden. And conspiracy theorists around the world believe this, but there's just no evidence for it. And surprisingly, there are very few things the U.S. government and bin Laden agree upon. But Ayman al-Zawahiri has released statements that there was no backing from the United States, other people within al-Qaeda. There really is just simply no evidence for that. The real story is not that the CIA knew who was helping out bin Laden. They had really no idea who he was until about 1995, when they first set up a unit especially looking at him directly in January of 1996. So really the story is not one of CIA complicity in the rise of bin Laden. It's actually ignoring the problem before arguably it was too late.
Yeah, and the blowback story is not so much that there was some kind of dark conspiracy to lead this guy to become suddenly the pariah he's become in the United States, but that they wanted a foil for the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. This became a problem later on, one that the CIA hadn't anticipated. 800-989-8255. Luke is on the line from Durango, Colorado. Hi, Luke.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
My question was, first of all, had Osama bin Laden mentioned Israel, and in particular, if so, did that have anything to do, does Israel's relationship with the United States have anything to do with his feelings towards the United States?
Thank you, Luke.
No doubt. I mean, Bin Laden, one of the people in the book says that Bin Laden started boycotting stuff like Pepsi and Sprite and 7-Up in the early 80s because of the United States' relationship with Israel. And Bin Laden has told his Pakistani biography the story that his father, who was one of the big builders of the region, was able to pray in the three holiest sites of Islam, Mecca, Medina, and also the mosque at Jerusalem, in the space of one day using a private plane. And certainly Bin Laden's father was very anti-Israeli. Certainly Bin Laden himself is pathologically anti-Israeli and anti-Semitic into the bargain. And our relationship with Israel certainly plays into his view of us.
But his focus has been the United States. And that, in fact, it was a source of conflict among others in the movement who saw Israel as the greatest threat.
Yeah, I think so. And, I've been puzzled. I was puzzled by the fact that they never attacked the United Israel or Jewish targets before 9/11. But as I was thinking it through, these people are pathological anti-Semites. And for them, the Pentagon was a Jewish target. I mean, they really believe their own propaganda that the Pentagon is entirely run by Jews. And so for them, 9/11 was an attack on an Israeli target, if you enter their worldview. But certainly Bin Laden has repeatedly said that one of his motivations for attacking the United States is its relationship with Israel.
Let's go to Ali, who's on the line from Princeton, New Jersey. Hello, Ali.
Yes, hi. I just want to make a comment, and if Peter can comment on it as well, is the fact that Osama bin Laden, being a Wahhabi, has a strong animosity towards the Shiite Muslims. After the Mujahideens were supported by the U.S., there was a lot of Shia-Sunni violence happening in the neighboring Pakistan because of that. And now, I mean, he stated out repeatedly how he hates the Shiites, and we now even say that the Iranians, who are dominantly Shiite Muslims, have harboring Al-Qaeda. How could that be possible?
Well, I would just disagree with you that Bin Laden's really never said, I think Bin Laden privately regards Shias as heretics. But he's been careful never to sort of denigrate them or talk about the Shias as somebody to attack. You know, Zakawi wrote Bin Laden a rather famous letter saying, let's foment a civil war in Iraq, let's kill the Shias, they're scorpions. Bin Laden really never replied to that. He has no interest in fomenting such a civil war, partly because senior members of al-Qaeda are living under some form of house arrest in Iran. In fact, Saad Bin Laden, one of Bin Laden's sons, is in Iran. And I just think that Bin Laden, that's just not a road he's ever chosen to go down.
Let's talk about al-Qaeda in Iraq and Osama bin Laden's relationship with Mahmoud Zarqawi.
Yeah. Well, their relationship has been, in the past, has been as much competitive as cooperative. Zarqawi, who's sort of a thug, he came out of the Jordanian prison system, went to Afghanistan, set up a training camp several hundred miles away from al-Qaeda's camps, maybe with some al-Qaeda help, but it was designed to be a separate organization with separate goals. I mean, Zarqawi really wanted to attack Jewish and Israeli targets and also the Jordanian government. Bin Laden wanted to attack the United States and by extension, authoritarian governments in the Middle East. So they had sort of philosophical differences, and they had they competed for money. Some of the people, one of the persons in the book that I, whose interrogation I quote for, talks about how they competed for resources. They really only came together as the Iraq War, heated up. And Zarqawi never swore an oath of allegiance to Bin Laden until 2004. 2 years into the war. So, Colin Powell had, at his famous UN presentation, said Zarqawi was the best evidence for this sort of al-Qaeda-Saddam Hussein nexus. Well, I just think that's nonsense. And in fact, I'm sure Colin Powell is regretting some of the statements he made there because the evidence shows that Zarqawi was actually had a competitive relationship with al-Qaeda, and it's only recently that he's entered into this spirit of cooperation and finally changed the name of his group to al-Qaeda in Iraq and finally sworn allegiance to bin Laden.
So it's the invasion and occupation of Iraq that invites al-Qaeda in and gives it a grounding and footing in.
Saddam Hussein didn't tolerate dissent of any kind. He wouldn't have wanted an opposition group, whether it's called al-Qaeda or, whatever the name of the group, he was a totalitarian dictator.
One of the most stunning things about this book, too, is the notion of the paradox. I mean, here is Osama bin Laden's greatest victory, the attacks on New York and in Washington, in effect being his downfall, that the most criticism he's received, and of course it ends really in disaster. You lose Afghanistan, you lose Iraq. And then the United States goes into Iraq, and you've got, maybe I could ask you to read this paragraph. That I have outlined here your book. Peter Bergen. Yeah.
The United States war in Iraq has energized al-Qaeda, its affiliated groups, and like-minded jihadists around the world. What has happened in Iraq is what bin Laden could not have hoped for in his wildest dreams. The United States invaded an oil-rich Muslim nation in the heart of the Middle East, the very type of imperial adventure that bin Laden has long predicted is the quote-unquote crusader's long-term goal in the region.
Yeah, so that makes that Sammy Sosa deal, you know, look like an act of genius. And so what I'm thinking is it's the paradox. It's the victories. The victory in Iraq, the victory in Afghanistan becomes, in a sense, the president's downfall, if we can characterize it that way. And certainly Osama bin Laden loses at the moment of his greatest victory.
Certainly 9/11 turned out to be a kamikaze mission for al-Qaeda. I think that it was... There's something that I report upon in the book is this internal debate that was going on amongst jihadists, even old allies of bin Laden, about what a disaster the 9/11 attacks were.
Let's go to the phones. Jessica is on the line from Reno, Nevada. Hello, Jessica.
Hi. I wondered if you would speak about Osama bin Laden's education and why he seemed to be very anti-education, especially for all the people in the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Thank you, Jessica.
Well, you know, Osama bin Laden's education is interesting, actually, because he didn't go to a madrasa. He went to a rather sort of, relatively speaking, progressive European-inflected school in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. He learned reasonable English, a language he chooses not to speak in. He then went to university, studied economics and public administration. His views on education for his own kids is that they should grow up, you know, memorizing the Quran and not really go and have formal educations. And Omar, the son I mentioned earlier who left bin Laden after 9/11, is apparently really feeling his lack of education. When he sees the other bin Ladens, of which he has 200 first cousins, they've all tended to be highly educated. But I think one other point I'd like to make is bin Laden's views not just on education but on his family life in general, which is sort of interesting. Bin Laden had a discussion with one of his closest friends at university and who became his brother-in-law about polygamy. And bin Laden said that, you know, our father's married 20 times. We're going to do polygamy the quote-unquote right way, which is we're only going to marry four wives. We're not constantly going to divorce them. And he gave his wives a deal at a certain point when they were living in Sudan. Bin Laden's always led a very ascetic life, living, sleeping on the floor, no air conditioning, no refrigerator. And he said to his wives, life is going to be hard, and basically now is the time to leave if you want to leave. And one of them left, along with his oldest son, Abdullah, who also left him and basically saying, look, we have all this money in the bank. Why are we living these like peasants? So bin Laden's his family life is sort of an interesting one, and it's one I was able to delve into to some degree with the caveat that, of course, information about this family is hard to come by. Saudi Arabia is a very closed society, and bin Laden has been very careful to reveal little about his personal life.
Well, and that also raises the question about this first-person testimony. On the one hand, quite authentic. This is the words of people. These are the words of people who knew him personally. But these people have a way of, or at least an interest in shading the truth and shading how they come out in this story. Are you concerned about that?
Well, that's true. If something was a bald-faced lie, I think you can tell. People at Guantanamo, I have some of their testimony in there, and you can make your own judgments if somebody at Guantanamo is telling the whole truth about why they were, let's say, around Tora Bora as the Taliban fell.
But in terms of their observations about Osama bin Laden, characterizations, their role, their relationship with him.
You know, I used my own judgment about what I thought, people were being straight with me. Maybe I'm hopelessly credulous person, but I tried to, exclude things that I thought were totally, were false or incorrect.
You are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Peter Bergen, author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know. And you can join that conversation by calling us at 800-989-8255. Let's go to the lines now with Stephen, who is on the line from the Jersey Turnpike. Pull over, Stephen.
Hi.
Pull over. Good afternoon.
I got a two-part question involving Al Jazeera and the Taliban. First part is, do you think Al Jazeera is assisting U.S. support in Afghanistan with fighting the Taliban and in Iraq with fighting the insurgents? And the second part of the question is, if the U.S. were to capture Osama bin Laden alive, would that broadcast on Al Jazeera grow support for the U.S., or would it hurt our attempts to reform in Afghanistan and Iraq?
You know, the best, in my view, the best public diplomacy we ever did was parading Saddam Hussein on camera and checking him for headlights. I mean, that was brilliant propaganda. And that's what we should capture bin Laden, and we should do the same thing to him, because we're dealing with a mythic figure whose you know, mythic persona must be punctured in the same way that we were dealing with a mythic figure with Saddam. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to capture bin Laden. By his own account, he wants to be, you know, die in the struggle. I take that sort of a face value. Is Al Jazeera sort of a stooge for al-Qaeda or sort of anti-American? My view is Al Jazeera is essentially largely a news organization with its own biases and has done some remarkable reporting around the world, including the only interviews with the operational commanders of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, where they laid out the whole plan a year after 9/11. And also Al Jazeera, is the sort of debate about whether Al Jazeera is a good thing or a bad thing, I think, is basically dead, because there are so many other Arab news satellite competitors, some conservative. You know, we have our own one called Al Hura, which is a U.S. government 24-hour news channel. And with the internet, you know, no one has a monopoly of information. So I think that I see Al Jazeera as basically a news channel with perhaps some biases that are different from, let's say, the U.S. government's view of the world, but I see them basically as a rather good group of journalists doing jobs in difficult places. They've been banned from a lot of Middle Eastern countries, for instance, Iraq, for instance, Saudi Arabia, because of their reporting.
Let's go back to the first part of Stephen's question. What would be the impact of a martyred Osama bin Laden, martyred, say, in the process of trying to catch him?
Oh, I think it would be bad. I mean, I think that in the short term, that would provoke a lot of anti-American attacks. And in the longer term, it would really, I mean, he's already a pretty large figure. I think it would pump him up even more. If you think about Saeed Qutb, who's really the ideological godfather of this movement, who was executed in 1966, it was his quote-unquote martyrdom that really turned him in, as much as his writings, that turned him into a very significant figure. And bin Laden is a much more well-known person than Saeed Qutb, and I think in death he would take on an even greater presence than in life. And that's not just my opinion. It's the opinion of a number of people who know him and that I interviewed in the book.
Is there any – what about the fact that unlike Qutb, Osama bin Laden doesn't have this body of printed work to live after?
Well, I mean, he's got a lot of statements. I mean, we've got, you know, by the way, there have been 18 videotapes and audio tapes from bin Laden since 9/11. One of the questions you ask, I think it was implicit, but why is he even important now? And my argument would be, look, these videotapes and audio tapes, which have been released, you know, 18 of them since 9/11, have, you know, brought pump up the base kind of messages, kill Westerners, kill Jews, and they also sometimes have specific instructions. For instance, attack members of the coalition in Iraq. Well, we saw the attack in Spain. Mm-hmm. We saw the attack in the United Kingdom. Attack oil facilities in Iraq and Saudi Arabia. We've seen an epidemic of these kinds of attacks. We haven't heard from him for a year. I'm an agnostic about what that means. I don't think it means he's dead. I think there would be a lot of evidence if he was dead. I mean, there would be all sorts of people who'd want to proclaim it, whether it was us or the jihadists who say, oh, finally, our great leader got his wish to be martyred.
What is his role today?
I think he's repositioned himself as the elder statesman of jihad. You know, remember the address he gave just before the U.S. presidential election?
Yeah, the campaign speech.
Yeah, it was sort of a Halloween parody of an Oval Office address. He was sort of sitting behind a desk. It was well lit. He spoke directly to the American people. By the way, he's not in a cave. Look, if you remember that, he's beautifully dressed. He looks tan and rested. It's a well-lit production. Clearly not, and he's very well informed. So it seems to me that he's not living in some, you know, remote cave. He's got a more comfortable situation than that.
Any idea where he might be?
I mean, yeah, everybody. I don't disagree with the general assessment that he's in Pakistan.
All right, and the impact is as elder statesman, so people still pay attention to him. He can still issue orders.
Well, I think the fact that Zarqawi pledged allegiance to him in 2004 and renamed his group al-Qaeda in Iraq shows that he continues to have this ideological importance.
Peter Bergen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Peter Bergen is author of The Osama Bin Laden I Know. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.